The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 366. From Eternity to Here, the Ways Mormons Have Talked About the Family Through History, a paper by Sonia Farnsworth.
And we're not going to give you her phone number, or her name. She's from San Jose, California. Her current title is Academic Counselor, University of Phoenix, San Jose Campus. She received a B.A. in English from BYU and an M.A. in Speech from San Jose State. It hasn't been posted until late August, so, you know, if you check her out, you know, that's why. She has published Mormonism's Odd Couple, The Priesthood Motherhood Connection in Women and Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism by Maxine Hanks. She is associated with the LDS Women, LDS Church, and Women Mormon Women's Forum. Awards and recognitions: she was twice voted in 1996 and 97 as outstanding tutor by the students in the federally run Aspire program at San Jose State University. Twice voted in 68 and 69 biggest lunch mouth by the girls in my BYU Heritage Halls dorm. I'd say that should be listed number one. Not you've got him just the opposite.
I was trying to be modest.
Okay. She has been married for 27 years to the same person. That's pretty good. She has four daughters, and she doesn't like children, she said. And she's been exploiting her dead homosexual uncle's reputation by association. He, for some reason, started normalized relations with Cambodia, and we could get into a big long story about that, but we won't. A pretty darn adorable cat named Casey, and her favorite movie is Glory, and her favorite book is I Hate to Cookbook, and her favorite color is black, which makes her look tragic. Which she doesn't look very tragic today. I'm going to excuse myself for a minute, and I'll be back to take questions when you are finished.
The previous speaker broke his glass. Just going to... reestablish myself here for a minute. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Okay, all right. My paper is entitled From Eternity to Here, 100 Years of Mormon Discourse on the Family. Last month, two clean-cut, conservatively dressed young men knocked on our door with a pro-family message. They spent a good deal of time up on our roof. They were chimney sweeps we had hired to give our chimney a good cleaning and a new spark arrester. Their pro-family message was on their business card. It said, clean chimneys, safe families. What interested in me was what it did not say, what voids of representation it contained in its self-affirming manifesto. What also interested me was how, as it equated the chimney sweeps with goodness and decency, in a world gone bad, it privileged one lifestyle and way of being, traditional family life. Today, although the privileging of traditional family life over other lifestyles is largely the domain of conservative Protestantism, we LDS are famously pro-family in our promotion of the family. Like the conservative Protestants, we promote a lifestyle based upon capitalism, heterosexual marriage, middle-class values, and the rearing of moral children as the true way of life, the only way to achieve a meaningful existence. This leaves us in a curiously conflicted situation. Like Protestants, we say things that connect our faith and our political views with our family life. We say things like, feminism has destroyed the family. The family is essential to our eternal destiny, and there is only one God-preferred model of family. Though we are partners with Protestants, We share a long and fractious history with them. It was a Protestant-inspired federal government that brought the church to its knees in the battle over plural marriage. There was and still is a Protestant-based anti-Mormon movement devoted to explaining that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is not Christian in any sense. Nevertheless, within the national pro-family movement, Mormons and Protestants are anxiously engaged in the same impassioned campaign to preserve the preferred status of the traditional family. Conservative Protestants have organizations with names like Focus on the Family and the Family Research Institute. We Mormons have the Family Home Evening Program, our award-winning Homefront Public Service Announcements, and the First Presidency's recent public announcement, The Family, A Proclamation to the World. Together, Protestants and Mormons have made their influence felt in support of such things as the Defense of Marriage Act, and most recently in California, the Knight Initiative to guard against the establishment of same-sex marriage. Although many conservative Protestants have noted that the Church's pro-family stance is inconsistent with its polygamous past, Latter-day Saints have issued statements to counter this fact. Last fall on Larry King Live, President Hinckley placed as much distance as he could between the church and polygamy in front of possibly tens of millions of secular viewers. In this way, he made the church more palatable to the American public, an act for which I do not blame him. 19th century American umbrage over Mormon polygamy brought the church such a conflagration of vilification and defamation that it has yet to be lived down. Given this, it is easy to understand why contemporary Mormonism considers its reputation as a practitioner of traditional family life a valuable asset. Instead of being burdened with labels such as a relic of barbarism, Mormonism is known by the multitudes as a church that is about strong families and traditional values. Instead of being greeted as I was many years ago by snide comments such as, "You're a Mormon, how many wives does your father have?" I am now greeted with comments such as, "You're a feminist? I thought you were a Mormon." Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your point of view, our pro-family-based approval is in jeopardy. Although for decades few have dared to question the link between Christian doctrine and the traditional family, those decades are over. In the early 90s, two credible Protestant scholars are seriously challenging the merits of the religion-family connection. In 1991, Abington Press, a well-known and respected publisher of Christian books, released Confronting the Idolatry of Family, A New Vision for the Household of God. The author, Dr. Janet Fishburn, a professor of American church history at the Graduate School of Drew University, argues in the book that there is no necessary link between Christianity and the traditional family. As she expresses it, Christianity's purpose is not the reinforcement of traditional family commitments, but the spreading of the good news of God's gift of grace and salvation. She criticizes pro-family ideology as hostile to the integration of people from other lifestyles into Christian communities, pointing out that Christian theology defines the church, not a biological kinship unit, as the primary family of its devotees. She particularly challenges two beliefs deeply entrenched in popular American culture and promoted by numerous denominations. A, that America's present moral decline is caused by the breakdown of the family, and B, that Christian families are the building blocks of civilization, without which neither nation nor children would be moral. Her work demonstrates that both ideas are rooted in popular culture rather than Christian theology. She outlines their ideological development as follows. During the 19th century movement to Protestantize America, Protestant missionaries learned that many potential converts were lost in the shuffle of their constant interdenominational disputes over doctrine. In a calculated effort to avoid this problem, they learned to bypass their diverse theologies by means of a strategy that resulted in a new kind of Protestantism, domestic Protestantism. Domestic Protestantism emerged when Protestant missionaries consolidated their interdenominational diversity under an umbrella doctrine based upon virtues that were already entrenched and revered aspects of American culture: the domestic virtues of hard work, individual morality, purity, and patriotism. By this tactic, they reframed the home as a little church charged with the development of Christian character in children. Thus, Protestant missionaries got a foot in the door of American homes with such success that America became a Protestant nation. As it made this transition, Christianity and idealized traditional family life became synonymous in the American mind. Janet Fishburne posits that the present moral panic about the breakdown of the family also does not arise from Christian teachings. She sees its roots in the post-World War II reemphasis on traditional family life, a morality-charged crusade that made alternate views of family emerging from the 1960s seem like a threat to the purpose and direction of Christianity itself. She advises Christian leaders to wean the church from its dependency on the Christian home for the following two reasons. Studies show that parents are not only overrated and unreliable as teachers of Christian values, but that Christians in non-traditional families feel excluded by pro-family teachings. She suggests that there is a need for churches to revise their curricula and provide their congregations with programs that are meaningful within a diversity of lifestyles. Following Fishburne, who wrote her book in 1991, was Rodney Clapp, who did a similar deconstruction of the religion-family connection entitled Families at the Crossroads, Beyond Traditional and Modern Options. Clapp, a former associate editor of Christianity Today and a contributor to the Christian Century, is general books editor for InterVarsity Press, the book publishing division of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, a student movement on campuses at hundreds of universities and schools of nursing in the United States. Clapp reprises Fishburne's argument that there is no fundamental doctrinal connection between Christianity and the traditional family, criticizes the conservative Christian preoccupation with family values, and affirms that the church, not the family, is the most significant influence upon the formation of a Christian character. He argues that the traditional family is not natural, not universal, or even biologically determined, but merely the product of modernity, and that its preservation in a postmodern world is pointless. He also challenges the conservative Christian tendency to equate capitalism with the Christian lifestyle. As he expressed it, the church's key responsibility is to live as the church in the light of the kingdom within a given host society. Christians are free to be grateful for the genuine blessings of capitalism, but we are also free, indeed called, to see and respond to its flaws. Clapp is concerned that because capitalism leaves families to work out their survival in an uncaring, economically insensitive marketplace, it fosters the very individualism and selfishness that pro-family Christians blame for family breakdown. Affirming that the true Christian family of Christian doctrine is not the family but the church, Clapp suggests that pro-family religion reduces Yahweh to a household god and Jesus to a domestic mascot. He condemns traditional gender roles as inimical to Christian marriage. Christian marriage, he proposes, is not a contract demanding gender complementarity that is violated when gender roles are not fulfilled. Rather, it is a covenant that transcends role restrictions and endures through time. To Clapp, Christianity is a vision much grander than that of what he calls a little family fixated on itself and its emotional coddling. Pro-family religionists will disagree with Fishburne and Clapp, but the arguments they present are powerful. Two leading Protestant thinkers, Martin Marty and Stanley Hauerwas, have praised their deconstruction of pro-family religion and called for a major configuration of contemporary assumptions about religion and the family. As the pro-family movement strives to defend the integrity of its very foundations, Mormonism will also be called upon to review the foundation of its present pro-family expressions. At this time, it will perhaps begin to reconsider the real Mormon position on the family. What has Mormonism said about the family throughout its turbulent history? To sum it up briefly, it has expressed two different and opposite views. While the Doctrine and Covenants, section 132, recommends plural marriage, the Proclamation on the Family recommends a family based on monogamy. While the Manifesto, under great duress, promises to refrain from recommending families based on plural marriage, the Church's homefront public service announcements enthusiastically recommend traditional family life as the Church's virtual raison d'etre. Naturally, one might ask, how did Mormonism move from one position to the other without a specifically announced doctrinal change? The answer can be summed up in two words: very slowly. The gradual path of Mormonism's changing discourse on the family can be tracked by reviewing a timeline comprised of 10 samples of Mormon discourse on family that begins with Doctrine and Covenants, section 132, and ends with the recent Proclamation on the Family. As mentioned earlier, Doctrine and Covenants, section 132, teaches the doctrine of plural marriage. This radical yet ancient vision of family was followed more than a half a century later by a document known as the Manifesto that has also been canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants. First place on the timeline that I will discuss is the Manifesto of 1890. Although the Manifesto of 1890 was focused upon Mormon notions of family, it did not denounce the Mormon doctrine of plural marriage, nor did it endorse the traditional family. It was a public announcement containing two distinct messages. First, a denial that Mormons had contracted new plural marriages after being forbidden to do so by the federal government, and second, an affirmation of Wilford Woodruff's promise to refrain from encouraging his people to participate in polygamy. In short, it was a reluctant and even grudging agreement to endure traditional family life. Prior to the Manifesto, Mormons had actually defended polygamy by arguing that God's preferred model of family was plural. Traditional family life, based on monogamy, they said, was not a solution to social problems, but the actual cause of moral decline in America. No one believed them, of course. Second place in the timeline is a speech entitled The Old-Fashioned American Home. In 1935, Apostle Stephen L. Richards, who at that time was in charge of the church's missionary program, addressed Americans on national radio. The church had just endured the national embarrassment of another polygamy scandal, and it seems that Elder Richards hoped to improve the church's public image by presenting the church in the most appealing light possible. He did so by equating Mormon values with American Protestant values and avoiding all references to plural marriage. When referring to Mormon families, who the American nation knew to be plural and thought of that way, he described them merely as large and devoted to the rearing of moral children. This made them the epitome of what he said existed throughout America, old-fashioned American homes, a factor he underscored by condemning apartment dwellers as lazy and dissolute. The only LDS notion of family he referenced was the eternal family. Praising America for its strong family values, he argued that Mormon families were just as virtuous as those found in old-fashioned American homes, except for one advantage. They remain together for eternity. Richard's speech was a discourse that represented the church's capitulation to traditional family norms. Third place in the timeline is a speech entitled Home and the Building of a Home Life. In 1952, Apostle J. Reuben Clark delivered a speech on the subject of wholesome family life at a General Conference meeting, or General Relief Society meeting. Nevertheless, the image of family he projected did not meet pro-family standards because it did not conform to rigid gender roles and had other features. Probably recalling the earlier expanded vision of womanhood proposed by Joseph Smith, Clark portrayed women as competent contributors to the public sphere as well as mothers in the private sphere. He further advised Mormon women that there were two keys to creating a good home life: genetic purity and avoidance of intermarriage with different races and religions. To support his position, he cited the ancient Hebrew belief that one should marry among one's own people to avoid the danger of infection with the heresies, the iniquities, and sinfulness that exist among unbelievers. This somewhat incongruous combination of mild feminism, mild eugenics, and mild racism defined the model of family his address presented. Surely it represented a rhetoric of transition as the church retreated from its earlier vision of family. Fourth place in the timeline is a speech entitled No Other Success Can Compensate for Failure in the Home. In 1962, Church President David O. McKay gave a General Conference address discussing the issue of family. As we have seen, there wasn't a tendency to speak about, quote, the family in the early part of the 20th century. Speakers made reference to the home rather than the family. President McKay's address followed that pattern as he debuted the now famous dictum, no other success can compensate for failure in the home. This maxim soon had for Mormons an almost scriptural authority and was assumed to have been McKay's own. Recently, however, editors of the Ensign have begun to cite its original source as J.E. McCulloch, author of a book entitled Home, the Savior of Civilization. It was published in 1924 by what appears to have been a Protestant press. This underscores the fact that contemporary Mormon notions of the family do not spring from fundamentally Mormon sources. In any case, taking his lead from McCulloch, President McKay did not advocate a preferred model of family, but addressed the issue of America's rising divorce rate. Moreover, the family he endorsed as preferred by God was not identified by its model, but by its ability to avoid failure in the home by remaining unbroken. Significantly, his remarks contrasted with those of Apostle Stephen L. Richards in the 1935 radio address. Elder Richards had portrayed American family life as strong and moral, equated Mormon families with old-fashioned American family values. President McKay took the opposite approach. His speech depicted the American family in moral decline and Mormon families with their projection into eternities as an example of rectitude and decency that could serve as a moral example to Americans in general. It was a vision of the family that heralded the church's newfound respectability within the United States. Fifth place in the timeline is a speech entitled Home, a Place to Save Society. In 1975, Church President Spencer W. Kimball addressed Swedish saints in a conference in Sweden. His remarks later appeared as a feature article in the January 1995 issue of the Ensign, entitled Home, a Place to Save Society. At this time, the Church Correlation Program had recreated the Mormon home as an auxiliary of the church under the direction of the Father. In his address, President Kimball urged Mormon families to participate in the church's new family home evening program. He promised them that regular family home evenings accomplished under the direction of the Father with the mother's support would be a panacea for moral decline.
This image of family conformed to the Protestant model, especially in that it portrayed traditional gender roles functioning as a key to salvation. Certainly, this view of the LDS family as a moral example to a corrupt world was an expansion of President McKay's earlier vision of the LDS family as an a moral example to the American family. In any case, it represented the development of a new era of respectability for American Mormons. Sixth place in the timeline is excerpts regarding the manifesto. In 1981, church leaders canonized selected remarks made by President Wilford Woodruff in the 1890s, directly after he had issued the manifesto. With its new, traditionally gendered and evidently monogamous missionary family at its helm, the church had reason to distance itself from its polygamous past. Many LDS at that time knew little more about the history and development of plural marriage than the fact that polygamy had once been practiced and then abandoned. The fly in the ointment of this efficacious loss of memory was Mormon fundamentalism. To put it briefly, because of the dedicated proselytizing of Mormon fundamentalists, mainstream Mormons were at the risk of discovering the disconcerting truth that the church had once taught and never expressly revoked a doctrine that plural marriage was essential for salvation. This created a need for church leaders to supplement the manifesto's equivocating and ambiguous denial of plural marriage. They titled this supplementary discourse excerpts from three addresses by President Wilford Woodruff regarding the manifesto. It wasn't a catchy title, was it? Briefly, these excerpts reprised the reasoning Wilford Woodruff had used to hold the church together when, after years of telling the saints they would never have to abandon plural marriage, he succumbed to governmental pressure and issued the manifesto. Trying to mend the breach between his two opposing statements, Woodruff paradoxically declared that people should continue to follow him because God would not allow him or subsequent church leaders to lead the church astray. The implication of this statement was that since the prophet cannot, by definition, lead the church astray, it is of no consequence where he has led it in the past or where he will lead it in the future. Therefore, Woodruff excused devout Mormons from critically analyzing any prophetic statements. Their only responsibility was to follow the prophet. With their position as a postscript to the manifesto in the Doctrine and Covenants, the excerpts were a discourse of paradox, canonized. As such, they represented the impossible situation in which the church found itself on the issue of family. Seventh place in the timeline is a speech called To the Mothers in Zion. In 1987, as part of an all-church fireside for parents, church president Ezra Taft Benson delivered an address entitled To the Mothers in Zion. Although it affirmed a common message of the day that women should remain in the home as full-time mothers, it also created great controversy among LDS women. President Benson had delivered it just as extraordinarily high levels of inflation caused LDS women to accept outside employment at a rate slightly higher than the national average. Concerned about what he perceived as a negative trend, he tried to persuade LDS women that stay-at-home mothering was of cosmic significance to the raising of moral children. Unfortunately, in doing so, he presented a vision of motherhood that was unrelenting, overwhelming, and impossible to perform. Unlike President Kimball's 1975 representation of women as partners in the fight against both international and domestic social and moral problems, in President Benson's speech, women were the social and moral problem. Certainly, the speech represented a change from J. Reuben Clark's 1952 image of women as effective and competent performers in both public and domestic realms. In addition, the speech met the criteria of the traditional family as it presented its anti-feminist perspective. Eighth place in the timeline is a speech that was given in 1993 entitled For Time and All Eternity. In 1993, Elder Boyd K. Packer gave a general conference address that appeared in the conference issue of the Ensign under the title For Time and All Eternity. It was a specific and pointed defense of the traditional family. Earlier, feminist and homosexual Mormons had challenged the church's traditionalist statements on gender by arguing that gender was not of divine origin, but historically and socially constructed. This left Elder Packer with the burden of arguing that gender roles were immutable and divinely ordained. To do so, he used scriptural references to establish that such roles were based upon natural and spiritual laws instituted from before the foundation of the world. He also introduced a new rhetorical tradition specifically created to defend the relationship of gender to salvation, the parable of the keys. By thus integrating gender roles further back into our cosmic histories and creating a pro-family message in the highly respected form of the parable, Elder Packer evinced a strong connection between the traditional family and fundamental Mormon doctrine. Since General Conference talks are considered quasi-scriptural, this amounted to a virtual, if not actual, canonization of the pro-family Protestant family within Mormon discourse. Nevertheless, at its roots, it was a discourse of anti-feminism and homonegativity. Ninth place in the timeline is the family, a proclamation to the world. It was in the context of the Hawaii same-sex marriage case that President Hinckley first read the family, a proclamation to the world in the 1995 Relief Society General Conference. Although a proclamation has less authority than a canonized text, it has great authority as a religious document because it seems unlikely that a church would address the world with concerns that were not indisputably related to its established doctrine. The model of family the proclamation apparently identified was not only based upon the pro-family model because it was built upon marriage between a man and a woman, but was described as, quote, central to the Creator's plan for the eternal destiny of his children. Moreover, on the matter of gender, it was a significant advancement of Elder Packer's 1993 statement that gender roles had been established before the foundation of the world. The expression, before the foundation of the world, hints at the possibility that we began as ungendered forms who became gendered as a result of a formative process that occurred in the preexistence. But the proclamation spoke of gender as, quote, an essential characteristic of our preexistent condition, hinting that it transcended time and space and therefore was not only immutable but co-eternal with God. Of significance is its final warning that, quote, the disintegration of the family would bring upon individuals, communities, and nations the calamities foretold by ancient and modern prophets. Recall that 19th century Mormons had spoken of the traditional family as the cause of American social problems, not the solution. With the proclamation's discourse of homonegativity, Mormon speech on the family seemed to have reversed itself completely. Clearly, the family kingdom launched from here to eternity by Joseph Smith has at least rhetorically been relaunched from eternity to here by the potent forces of secular-inspired domestic Protestantism. The long journey of the Mormon family from polygamy to monogamy can be seen in terms of two metaphors, amnesia and ventriloquism. The metaphor of amnesia lends itself to a better understanding of how Mormonism's doctrine of plural marriage faded into a doctrine of the traditional family. Just as amnesia often is acquired after a trauma, the church, quote, forgot its original doctrine of family after the trauma of a prolonged federal assault that threatened it with destruction. Just as amnesiacs must recreate the world around them based upon the prompting of the host community, the church learned a new concept of family from the larger Protestant-dominated nation in which it was situated. Moreover, just as victims of amnesia have occasional memory flashbacks, the church is subjected to these as members encounter canonized documents such as the manifesto and the excerpts, or are approached by the fundamentalists and those who write unexpurgated versions of Mormon history and anti-Mormons. Because the church is dependent for its survival upon the larger society, such recollections that strain its credibility are disconcerting. As a result, it is understandable that the church tends to punish those who facilitate the resurrection of these subjugated memories, people like feminist Mormons, liberal intellectuals, and Mormon fundamentalists. Under these conditions, Mormonism has survived by practicing its amnesia through a discourse that indicates its respectability to the larger community. In his 1935 radio address, Stephen L. Richards seems to have feigned amnesia after plural marriage had resurfaced and threatened to ruin the church's reputation with the public at large, without whose approval it could not fulfill its mission to convert the world. After some time, the church's revisionist history created a situation in which the church's amnesia was genuine because the membership had lost touch with the past. I believe that Richard's radio address was an early manifestation of a survival strategy the church would later adopt, the repetition of society's accepted notions of family. In facilitating these repetitions, the church seems to have entered into a process I call theological ventriloquism. In its desire to survive by squelching its own unique expressions of family, it has sometimes deliberately and sometimes not repeated words that were thrown to it by the Protestant-inspired federal government and the general public. For those of us who are old enough to remember, it could be said that the church has taken on the role of Charlie McCarthy to the federal government's Edgar Bergen. Certainly, the manifesto and the Homefront public service announcements, which are the result of purposeful public relations research, this is a case. By dint of this Charlie McCarthyism, the church has kept itself relatively safe in the lap of American approval and purchased its own survival. From this vantage point, it has united with the Protestant pro-family movement and engages in a discourse that opposes those who pursue models of family that are no less radical than its own original doctrine of family, especially if one considers the recent discovery of polyandry within Nauvoo. But as the saying goes, the church is no dummy. It is noteworthy that Charlie McCarthy, with his perpetual smile, is eerily alive and implacable. In the case of Mormonism, this implacability is, metaphorically speaking, real. Behind its cordial public decorum, the church conceals a history of creative resistance towards its oppressors. Its rhetorical resistance to federal efforts against plural marriage was dedicated and creative. If the contemporary church is not consistent with the 19th century church regarding its doctrine of family, it is not because the 19th century church did not do its level best to be faithful to its original teachings. If this rhetorical resistance was true of the manifesto, it is equally true today of the proclamation. Cleverly, the proclamation does not use the word traditional in reference to the family, nor does it rule out polygamy. It defines a marriage between a man and a woman, not one man and one woman. In other words, should the notion of the traditional family lose favor within Protestantism, which is now a definite possibility, the church has not really committed itself to that model of family, at least not technically. That this is a mere technicality becomes clear when one reads other pertinent documents. A letter read in California sacrament meetings on May 11th urged church members to oppose same-sex marriage and referred to one man and one woman. And the church's friend of the court brief submitted to the Hawaii State Court referred to the traditional family. But the doctrinal expressions of this concern did not mention either one of those terms. What are the implications of this study for faithful Mormons? If Protestantism discredits the traditional family, What will we do with the recent proclamation? If we can no longer find safety in our reputation as clean living traditionalists, how will we maintain our identity? Here are some thoughts I have on the subject. If Protestant scholars deconstruct pro-family ideology, we will no longer be the only church who has to eat crow over our history of practices and beliefs about the family. Protestantism will have considerable egg on its face, a virtual omelet, while Mormonism will have only some conspicuous but excusable patches of dry egg yolk. But there's more. Once the traditional family is dethroned, the coast will be clear for us to identify, discuss the merits of, and decipher the meanings behind the real Mormon doctrines of family. The church can come out of the closet regarding Joseph Smith's family kingdom with its combination of polyandry, polygyny, and male-to-male adoption, as well as the Old Testament polygyny that evolved from it. LDS people can freely ask many questions that we have repressed and suffered over for a long time. Many of us have been asking questions framed in traditional sensibility, such as what was Joseph thinking when he experimented with polyandry and Old Testament polygyny? Free of the canons of traditionalism, we could ask quite directly, what was he thinking and what was he trying to say? What did he mean to tell us about relationships? What was he saying about sexuality, economics, gender roles, the locus of morality, of heaven? In speculating and pondering these questions, we LDS people might escape the boundaries of pro-family discourse that tends to recycle a small number of platitudes bemoaning the breakdown of the family and condemning feminism and homosexuality. We could offer fresh and genuinely Mormon contributions to the national conversation about family values. One LDS notion of family that virtually never arises in the national conversation is the sacred, not secret, of concept of family arising from the temple ceremony. It is, after all, a legitimate and provocative perspective. It stands on its own because it is not implicated by the deconstruction of the traditional family, because the temple ceremony is not about the traditional family. The temple's promise of exaltation is laid out in a rich scenario that moves well beyond the traditional family. In the temple, heaven is not found in a place or a kinship model or any combination of the two, but in a sacred vision of eternal relationships and interconnectedness. As we see ourselves through this exalted perspective, we are not separate little families charged with the raising of righteous children. We are the eternal family of God. In the temple, we are exalted not because we have enforced the boundaries of the traditional family, but because we have transcended them to acknowledge the permanent, everlasting family that is already ours. In the temple, gender roles are superseded by the notion of male and female as one flesh. The distinctions between male and female are not accentuated, but placed into a new perspective. In this new perspective, the boundaries between male and female are blurred. In the temple, heaven is not contingent upon the traditional family providing an opening to spirituality. Spirituality is contingent upon a vision of humanity as one, and it is as this vision that provides an opening to heaven. In the temple, the human network forged does not privilege the traditional family above all models because there are numerous plural families sealed into its expansive web. In the temple, individual couples are both the living and the dead are allied, affiliated, associated, attached, bonded, confederated, connected, linked, related, unified, in short, sealed into a ceaseless web of interrelationships. In the temple, brothers and sisters in the gospel have performed countless vicarious ordinances for the dead, not to make everyone a Mormon, but because they so loved the world that they could not envision a heaven in which anyone was excluded. In the words of an LDS hymn, "Our blessed communion, fellowship divine,
All are one in thee, and all are thine. In the temple, we do not hold the domestic sphere sacred, but reach out to those outside it. We do not even know these brothers and sisters for whom we act as advocates and in whose place we enter the celestial kingdom. They could be conservative or liberal, moral or immoral, criminal or law-abiding, pro-life or pro-choice, feminist or anti-feminist, Mormon or anti-Mormon, gay or straight, or impossible to categorize, or just impossible. But no matter what they are, for a time they become one with us. We are they, and they are we, and in this marvelous merging, we take them to heaven.
Thank you, Sonia. One of the reasons why I wanted to share this session is because I've been kind of intrigued with this subject. I've been reading a book called The Way We Never Were. You're familiar with it, okay. Who's the author?
Stephanie Coons.
Stephanie Coons. Good, somebody else is reading it. And I've been intrigued by some of the observations she's made about the so-called traditional American family. In a nutshell, and correct me if I'm wrong, she seems to be making the observation that the so-called traditional American family that we keep talking about, politicians and religious leaders love to talk about and invoke, never really existed to the degree that we say it did, and it never existed in the way we think it did, and it still doesn't exist now. And if it ever did, it existed in small pockets as forms of aberrations. She also seems to make the case that it's not nearly as bad as we think it is. Things have improved in many aspects for the American family, and that it's much more complex. It's not just this linear decline of the American family, that aspects have improved, things have gotten worse. That's a very complex situation. What I wanted to ask you, since I get to be the chair and I get to ask the first question, is since you've read the book, or at least are familiar with it.
I've read it.
Okay. would you say her observations are relatively true in terms of the Mormon culture? The Mormon culture that existed in the 19th century. Obviously, we've got the added aspect of polygamy that colored the definition of families, et cetera, in 19th century American Mormon culture. But would you say that much of her conclusions parallel Mormon culture, and what would you say is different? And also, if we were to go back in time with the Proclamation on the Family and present it to Utah culture in 1880, how would it be different and how would it be received differently? Or the same?
Okay, that'd be fine. The first question was, did I think that Stephanie Coons's kind of deconstruction of ideal American family life applies to the Mormon family? I would say yes, it does, because what Stephanie Coons was really deconstructing was a fantasy theme that developed in Mormon, in American life, and Mormon life was American life, and anything that falls short of the fantasy is exactly that process that she's talking about. So I would say that Mormon family life has all of the same problems that regular American family life has. And it can be disappointing. And that's the problem. The discourse and the fantasy theme raises our expectations. And she talked about that to some extent, saying that divorce is sometimes increased because our expectations have increased. One thing that concerned me as I was reading her book and several others on the subject was that pro-family discourse raises our expectations of family life so much that real family life can seem a disappointment. And that raises the divorce rate because of the fact that discontent and high expectations work together to make people want out of families. And your second question, I forget now. Oh, the if the proclamation of the family was written in eight.
Well, if we took the exact same one and presented it to the Mormons then, would they receive it the same way today, or would they?
No, because they, as I mentioned earlier, they were coming at. Oh, you weren't here. That's right. Shame on you. When the church tried to defend polygamy from its critics in the 19th century, its main argument was that the traditional family was the cause of American social decline. So, on that basis, if a Protestant missionaries came and argued to them that traditional family life was going to save them, they would not have believed it. Yes?
Question is whether I need to record the questions on this. The question is whether you haven't cited any text that refers to what the traditional definition of family was in the 19th century Protestantism. Is that the question? LDS definition. Okay.
Well, one primary text is a letter by Belinda Pratt to her sister, written in 1855. I believe there are also, you could look at the Smoot hearings and other sources, but I thought that the Pratt letter was the one I cited in the paper was a primary source. I'm not sure that people really believed that either. I think they were just arguing, and when you argue, you pull what you can out of your hat. So the sincerity of that argument is in question.
Somebody ask a question before I do. Yes.
Feminists, plural marriage. The traditional family in just generally in the secular world is a subject of concern for feminists because it implicates with a kind of a guilt and a sin women who have to work outside the home. And it also has legislative implications when we make laws and when we consider issues such as daycare. If we have a kind of a punitive attitude towards women who work and suggest that by breaking up the proper gender role or departing from proper gender roles, they're contributing to the delinquency of minors and things like that, that then we wouldn't want to provide them with support systems such as daycare. So there is an effect on that's one of the reasons that feminists have argued against that. A small group of people have argued that plural marriages bring out the independence of women, and that's kind of feminist. But I don't see that a lot in Mormonism. I'm probably the only Mormon feminist who's ever said anything really positive about, who doesn't feel like plural marriage is really a severe danger. I wouldn't mind experimenting with it, but I mean that's just me. I like to experiment. I never have experimented either. That's a sad story. Sorry, everyone.
Yes.
Yes. That's true that feminists are always blamed for destroying the family. There's one of the groups that's often cited. But in fact, the legislative history shows that they're always trying to do things that have to do with women's issues. Things that men don't really think about very much because, well, they don't have breasts, they don't have wounds, they don't have all the truck that women have to carry around. And so that reflects their... But there seems to be a complete disconnect between American impressions of feminists on that in that way. You're right. I don't know an answer yet. I'm not aware of that. As a feminist, I welcome the idea of same-sex marriage because I think it contributes to solid households. But it seems that conservatives are the ones who are concerned about the idea of plural marriage or polygyny becoming legal, and more so than feminists. I don't know. Maxine Hanks is a feminist sitting in the back there. What do you think? Are feminists concerned about if we allow same-sex marriage? Are they concerned that polygamy is the next step? Well, I don't know. I don't see a whole concern about that. It has intrigued me, however, because I want to know, what's the church going to do? How's it going to be consistent? We always think that religions have to be consistent. Who is the theologian who wrote a book called A Systematic Theology? I mean, now that, and religions are pretty inconsistent, but when they're inconsistent big time like this, it does cause problems for them. So I'm more worried about what the Mormon Church is going to do, because if the Mormon Church decides to do something that I don't want to do, it's not likely that I'm going to go along with it. That's kind of a non-issue for me. And maybe that would be the case with Mormon feminists who have basically made that same decision.
Isn't the essence of feminism teaching women and men how to empower themselves to realize their full potential and granting them the freedom to do that? If a person wants to do that through polygamy, isn't that part of feminism? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, whether polygamy is degrading to women or not, at least don't we want to give people the choice to be degraded or not?
Yeah. Well, I have a very close friend who's a polygamist, and she is very happy. I don't see any unhappiness or abuse from her spouse. She's happier in this polygamous marriage than she has been in her monogamous marriage of 25 years. And interestingly, her polygamous spouse is more empowering to her. He encourages her to do a lot of the things that she wants to do, and is a lot like my husband in monogamy, who's always encouraged me. So it depends on the person.
Yes.
Well, it was discovered by reviewing the records of Joseph Smith's marriages that he had married women who remained married to other men at the same time. So Todd Compton really recently wrote a book called In Sacred Loneliness that goes through all of the wives of Joseph Smith, does little histories of their lives, but he does also deal with the fact that many of them, 11 I believe, were also married to other men that they cohabited with at the time. So the notion of polyandry is a relatively new notion to even to Mormon historians, and it's only just been
cursorily observed and discussed. It could be something to discuss. I like it because at least it makes polygamy equal. Before we had lopsided polygamy, and now we have kind of equal polygamy. And so from that perspective, I think it's an intriguing notion. And if I can use Joseph Smith, Ms. Smith's authority as a prophet of God to excuse that kind of behavior, isn't that a fun thought?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tackle that one.
Well, I think what you've said is what you've described is a situation and a concept of male-female relationships and family models that goes very much against the grain. And I'm inclined to dismiss it because of my cultural proclivities, but because of my proclivities and my cultural training, I'm suspicious of my inclination to reject it before I at least review it. What was he doing? And I'm not ready to just dismiss it as just lust. I don't know why, because I'm sure if I did anything like that, it would be completely done for lust. But I somehow give Joseph Smith some slack on that. And but if we can look beyond our culture for a while, I think that we could at least give Joseph the benefit of the doubt as a prophet, because prophets are generally audacious. They do go against cultural grain, and sometimes painfully so. So I think it's worth a closer look for a long time.
Well, you yourself referred to how everybody was being sealed to everybody, men and women, married people. There was this kind of like emphasis on adopting everybody's family and everyone trying to get adopted to Joseph in one way or another. And so it was more than just that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
It seemed to go in many ways. Maxine?
Yeah, it was sort of died out later, but it was a little bit. No,
yeah.
They're not.
Are we out of time? Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.
It's nice to meet you, Mark.